Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this morning from another bluebird wintry day here in West Kelowna, British Columbia. In today's program, we return our focus to pressing issues here in British Columbia and wade back into the mucky mire of the Site C Dam project. Joining us today is an energy expert, Mr. Robert McCullough. Mr. McCullough has produced a number of reports to date regarding Site C, with the most recent one being published at the end of February 2021. Mr. McCullough is the principal of McCullough Research in Portland, Oregon, and has been in the business for over 25 years, advising governments, utilities, and First Nations on energy, metals, paper, and chemical issues. He has testified repeatedly in state, federal, and provincial courts, as well as before Congress and other regulatory bodies. His testimony in front of the Senate Energy Committee is credited with initiating the Enron trading investigations, during which time he worked for the U.S. Department of Justice and three Western attorneys general. Before starting McCullough Research, Mr. McCullough was an officer at Portland General Corporation, where he had responsibilities in finance, power marketing, and rate setting. He was educated at Reed College, Portland State University, and at Cornell University in economics and finance. He is a member of the American Economic Association and the American Financial Association. He has also been an adjunct professor and visiting scholar of economics at Portland State University since 1996. Mr. McCullough, it's a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for your time and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yes, very well. It's been a while since we tried to get you on, so I'm glad we finally get a chance here at this important conjuncture in this project. So first off, Mr. McCullough, from reviewing your CV, it appears that you've dedicated much of your professional life to the energy sector. What predicated this focus?
Well, frankly, just fascination. When I was right out of college, we had the original oil boycott. And so being in college and graduate school in the 70s, it was a fairly obvious area to focus on. In fact, I can remember at Cornell while I was in the doctoral program, being at a dinner party with some assistant professors, and one of them and his wife noted that they would take a hot bath, then run to their bedroom, get under their electric blanket, get warm and toasty, and then turn off the electric blanket. And he was a nice fellow, and so I didn't point out to the fact that the most energy effective part of that entire mix was the electric blanket, and he should give up the hot bath. So it's an area, energy is an area that fascinates, but also we make astonishing mistakes. Information is difficult to find and used in misleading ways. And so we have any number of interesting issues to work on at any given moment. In fact, I'm working on gasoline in California, coal in the upper Midwest. We just were retained to work on the ERCOT rolling blackouts. And of course, we work for Westmoberly and the Peace River Landowners Association of Farmers in British Columbia.
Right, right. Well, that's a great segue into the Site C. And my first question really there, in your opinion, has this or is this project essentially economically obsolete given the newly revised budget, which has just been released?
I think everyone now agrees it is. As you remember, in 2017, Premier Horgan asked the Regulatory Commission to review it. They did a careful review. They said, well, at the time, it's pretty nose to nose with renewables. And that, I think, was a very conservative estimate. I believe at the time it already failed to compete with renewables. But now that its price is roughly double that, I think there's no question that alternatives are much better. A simple test, can you buy the power today at a price cheaper than it will be produced in 2025? The answer is yes. You open your web browser, you go to the Intercontinental Exchange, and you simply put in an order for the power in 2025. I would recommend bringing a very large credit card to this operation, but you can actually buy for power supplies on the world markets. And the price of that at the moment is approximately a third of Site C.
Yeah, so I mean, that's pretty damning economics on the project then.
Well, good for the United States, however, and as a U.S. citizen, I would like to thank Premier Horgan for spending $16 billion to provide energy he'll be selling to us at a vast discount. But as an economist, I think the answer is yes, it's probably a very bad investment in job creation.
Right, right. So in your recent report then, dated February 28th, 2021, you make the remark that Site C Dam is now having the distinction of being the most expensive hydroelectric project in Canadian history. Can we explore that statement in a little more detail, please?
Certainly. People tend to fail to notice that hydroelectric projects are basically a bounty provided by God. And for those of us who live near the Rockies, obviously, we understand that a little better than most. The best hydro sites are geological. And so some of the best hydro sites in the world are along the Columbia River in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. Those were very inexpensive to build. They were very safe to build. They've been here for a long time. As you use up those really nice sites, the sites become less and less attractive. And that's simply because the Peace River sites, A, B, C, D, and E, turned out not to be very good sites. And we're down to the last site, Site C. And we're now finding that that is being built on shale, which is rather biblical about this morning. I was built on sand, so to speak. So the situation in building projects, when you're further down the road in terms of using up the best sites, is that you're forced to go to locations that are more and more challenging. In defense of BC Hydro, they really didn't have a sense of the huge geotechnical problems they were going to face on both banks of the river. In 2017, they had to reveal that they were behind schedule and over budget by several billion dollars. Obviously, this past month, British Columbia has discovered that they're now behind schedule and over budget by another $5 to $6 billion. So this is what happens when one is desperately trying to develop an inappropriate site. And in their defense, as I said, this was not obvious when they started, but it isn't surprising. So there are four major hydroelectric projects underway in Canada. All are behind schedule and over budget. And in Manitoba, Kiask is currently under a variety of investigations. In Quebec, the most experienced of the hydro developers, La Romaine, the last project is a year behind and over budget. Though in Quebec, where everything is secret, we don't even know what the budget is. But of course, Muskrat Falls in Labrador is massively over budget and behind schedule. Moreover, really has no place to send the power once it's done, which is
even a bigger problem.
Yes. However, sadly for Premier Horgan, even more sadly for ratepayers and taxpayers in British Columbia, has now achieved the most expensive project of the four. And of course, all four are the most expensive projects of hydro developments built in Canada. By comparison, the developments along the Columbia River, which started development now 80 years ago, are a fraction of this price and much safer because they're not built in a geotechnically challenging area. That's true of both the Canadian projects north of the border and the US projects south of the border. So bottom line is, both in British Columbia and in the US Pacific Northwest, we've plucked the low hanging fruit And what we're finding is the remaining fruit is pretty sour.
So just a question on capacity. I mean, it's one thing to be the most expensive project, but where do those other projects rank in terms of their output? Are they all generally similar, or is this Site C not only producing less power and costing more?
They're roughly comparable. Site C is a little bit of capacity, but these are nowhere near the size of the major projects. These are not like the Grand Coulee in the U.S. or the Grand Two, the Bourassa Dam in Quebec, which are six times as large. However, it is a large dam, 1,100 megawatts. That would normally be enough to support a million homes on peak. And so it's not as if these are small undertakings.
Right. Excuse me. So this entire project seems to be bearing witness to endlessly increasing costs. Are you aware of sort of the staggered increase from the inception point until today? I mean, what was our original budget for completion versus what are now at $16 billion?
Well, it depends on how far back you go. BC Hydro has wanted to build this project for many, many years. And as a young manager at Portland General Electric in the 80s, I can remember them presenting the project to Portland General and asking if we would like to be a partner. We turned them down because it was too expensive then. I can't remember what the number was, but we were astonished at the prices they were quoting. We have seen the prices evolve every year since then. And so the amount of money has been pretty speculative until they actually started to build. So when we were entering into the 2017 period, we were talking about numbers in the $8 billion range. That was very high at the time. And that did not fare well in the regulatory case. In fact, BC Hydro stated at the outset that they were on schedule and on budget, a position that they immediately reversed themselves on within the month, as I remember. Since then, we've had the shift to above $10 billion that occurred in January of 2018. But it was fairly clear to everyone that we were going to miss the schedule this fall. In fact, I wrote a report in October noting that they were going to miss the schedule by a year. And there was nothing magical about that. It was not COVID, by the way. It was simply, it's a complex project and they were missing those deadlines. And they were almost a month late on the diversion of the river, which is an issue of some danger. But they went ahead and diverted it anyway in the fall. Again, without any public comment. And so this is just a large, challenging project in an inaccessible area with unusual geotechnical problems. And each time they look up, there's another large bill to pay.
Right. But I guess the geological problems were known as far back as the mid-50s. Is that not correct? Or at least the potential for those problems.
Indeed, they were. And that's why, as I said, sites A, B, D, and E were abandoned over those.
Okay. Okay. So site C was sort of seen as the best of the worst.
Right. And so, but it was not Albania Falls or any of the other projects we think of along the Columbia River. This is a challenging location.
Yes. So, and before we go much further, I think it's poignant to discuss the actual specific economics of energy production at Site C, which you highlight in your recent report. Maybe we'll first look at the updated 2021 budget and what those figures relate to. And then maybe we look back to 2017 when the Horgan government decided to push ahead, what the economics looked like even back then.
You know, I apologize. I don't have it in front of me. Oh, my God. Well, you'll pick it up.
Sure, yeah. If you wouldn't mind, I think that's a really important aspect of this whole thing. And you summarized it so nicely in there.
Rushing around a bit this morning, so
that's fine, sir. You're a busy man. You got lots on your plate. We appreciate you taking time out to share your knowledge here with the listeners on this subject.
Oh, we appreciate your far-reaching and interesting programs. Very good. Sorry about that.
Yeah, not a problem.
So you asked about the economics. And
yes.
Let me clarify an important issue about major projects. When you undertake a multi-year project like this, you usually generate an instant estimate of the cost of the project. That is, the cost of the equipment, the manpower, et cetera, as if you could build the project in 1 month. That gives you an idea of all of the ingredients of the final budget. But that's not actually gives you the final answer. Case in point, you go to the lumber yard and the hardware store and you buy all of the materials for your new garage and you have them lying in your driveway. That's the instant cost. However, to go from there to a garage is going to take some time. And so there'll be additional costs. Quite often, a major one is interest during the construction. So when we look at the instant costs of Site C in 2017, we were actually further along in the project than we are today. And the reason is that we now have a lot more in front of us in terms of meeting those geotechnical issues. So when the British Columbia Utility Commission reviewed the project in the fall of 2017. The project was 48% of the way along. But now with the additional $5 billion of required investments, we've fallen to only 35%. So in fact, the project is becoming more expensive and more complex and more lengthy, faster than the passage of time. In a sense, we're chasing a result that's getting further and further away from us. And that also drives the cost dramatically because we now have an additional 4 years at the very least of interest to pay on the existing $6 billion, even before we spend the final $10 billion to bring the project into completion. And all of which, of course, assumes that for the first time in the history of Site C, that our estimates are correct. And as we know, Site C's estimates have never been correct.
So it's like a giant open pit to throw money into, it looks like.
Well, it's a scary open pit to put money into. And, you know, we've gone through these revisions again and again. As I said, in all four of the provinces where major projects are underway. The fact of the matter is, the science of building a series of piles underneath the dam to support it in case of an earthquake is speculative, at the very least. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's not something that's been done every day.
Yes. In fact,
it's new to the Rockies, and we'll find out whether it's appropriate to the Rockies. Hopefully we'll find out before the dam slides. And but even if we do it right, it's clear that we may not do it right the first time.
And then I guess the other complicating factor there is the L-shaped layout, which has never been implemented in this fashion. So that adds another layer of complexity and risk.
Well, and also the construction methodology. We're using rolled cement, a technology pioneered, by the way, in Oregon. And the rolled cement technology is very different than the traditional cement and rebar technology that we think of. The first dam to be built, the one in Eastern Oregon, required substantial repairs before it was finally operational. One of the issues is that it is not as water impermeable as a traditional dam. And so if there is an earth tremor or whatever, then the question is, will the dam be able to retain the water? That's one of the reasons why the increased budget addresses and adding a lot more fill to the Earthville Dam.
Yes. Yeah. So just if we could circle back to the economics and discuss the actual, what our cost of production is anticipated to be here and what, you know, compared to, I guess, our market price.
Very good. Okay. So first thing is, if we're talking about the rate that will be charged to ratepayers, that is all of the money so far spent plus the $10 billion, we're talking about Canadian $134 per megawatt hour. And that's a very, very high number. And the market at the moment is $37 per megawatt hour. Now, when I say the market, I want to specify that's not a forecast. At the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the Intercontinental Exchange, you can actually buy electricity in 2025. You put down your money and it will be delivered to you in 2025. That electricity is delivered at the Columbia River, not surprising. And then there are some extra charges to bring it to Canada. But one way or another, you're ending up with a very expensive alternative. And the alternative comes out to approximately three times, as I see, is approximately three times the cost of the alternative. In our report, we actually built the calculations showing the cost of building Site C and then exporting it to the US. And if you do that, then in fact, you lose $97.76 Canadian for every megawatt hour that you sell to the Americans. As I said earlier, as an American, I think this is a pretty good deal. Unfortunately, as an economist, I don't think we should do it. Alternatively, we could import the power from the US, and then we would only lose $82 if we built Site C. And in both cases, there's nothing magical about that. We've had a tremendous technological change over the last decade. The cost of wind and solar has declined dramatically It's now down into the $30 per megawatt hour range. And that's driving lower market prices across the US and Canada. So not only is Site C ballooning upwards in costs, but the alternative are falling dramatically at the same time.
And so that obviously, those estimates are with today's rounded $16 billion budget, which we have no assurance that's the final cost. So the this loss per megawatt could continue to increase over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years before this thing is commissioned.
Absolutely. The both the press and ourselves have noted that much of the increase is now mysterious. It's been blamed on COVID, but obviously the COVID delay to the degree there was one was already in place. So we don't really know what year that will occur or what components will occur. Now, obviously, most of us believe that it is the non-slip piles that will stop the dam from sliding if there's a earth tremor or the increased size of the dam. That's the logical assumption. But Premier Horgan did not provide a new budget, nor did he address some of the other issues, which generally are not well understood in British Columbia. And I'd like to spend a moment talking about that.
Sure.
At the outset of all this, BC Hydro decided to hedge the interest rates. And through no fault of theirs, that was a terrible decision. So to hedge an interest rate, you go again to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the Intercontinental Exchange, and you buy an interest rate hedge. And in effect, what you say is, I will make sure the interest rate goes no further than X. And to the degree the interest rates actually fall, then you will end up paying the person who provided the hedge. The last time we saw numbers from BC Hydro, they had lost $1 billion in that hedge.
Wow.
And that's not sitting in, as far as we can tell, in these amounts. But it gets worse. As you know, the governments of both Canada and the US and the European governments are all using their budgetary and financial strategies to support demand. That's exactly what they should do during the pandemic. And that's driven interest rates down to all-time lows. Each time that interest rate falls, the cost of that hedge increases. Now, because BC Hydro has become very quiet on this issue, you can't blame them. It's terribly embarrassing. They're now above $1 billion losses, and that $1 billion is increasing. We can't even guess what it is now because they've not reported that even to the BCUC in some time. So there's a variety of additional factors that Premier Horgan did not address in his press conference, but really do need to be addressed simply because all of those are being paid for by BC Hydro ratepayers today. Taxpayers today. It's not even gone into rates. So at the moment, right, it's showing new taxes.
So let me just clarify this. So that this additional billion, which will potentially continue to increase as the time moves forward and interest rates stay low, that number may not be reflected in this $16 billion budget either. Is that my understanding? Is that correct?
It's never before been reflected in their budget.
Okay.
Since we don't really know what the budget is and haven't known what the budget is for some time, we are forced to guess what's in it. But my guess is that our $16 billion probably needs to be increased to $17 or $18 billion if we include this unfortunate financial hedge.
Interesting. And so, you know, to me, this math sounds very similar to the math that the province is using to justify their LNG projects.
Yeah, having been advised on one of the LNG projects, it has a lot in common. The LNG project issue is actually very similar. The price of natural gas went to unbelievably high levels in Japan after their nuclear accident, and they shut down their nuclear program and replaced the generation with natural gas. Obviously, quite a while ago, and in the interim, they have replaced the damaged nuclear reactors with other generation, and the price of natural gas has fallen dramatically. So the lack of adjustment of the plans for the LNG export terminals to the reality that the dislocation in Japan was temporary led to 20 projects being announced for British Columbia and 2 in Oregon, by the way. And to the best of my knowledge, all but one have now been canceled.
Well, I think wood fiber in Squamish is still sputtering along. They're from what I understand, and of course, with the LNG plant up in Kitimat is under construction, and it looks like that's full speed ahead.
I think you're correct. Wood fiber is, as I remember, a relatively small one.
Yes, and I don't even believe they've broken ground on that yet. They're still in the planning and permitting stage at that one.
So, you know, when you're talking about a project that can take 5 to 10 years to produce, and you're counting on the economics staying constant, this is a pretty scary undertaking. And so both LNG and Site C face the same issue. The fundamental preconditions for the project change dramatically over the period. The Oregon project that was just canceled in January was originally built to import natural gas to the United States and Canada. That was 10 years ago. Seems incredible to us today, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. So one thing that we continue to hear out of our comrades in Victoria is that they can't abandon the project because of the sunk costs which are there, and that's simply too high to walk away from. Can you explain the sunk cost concept to us? I think this is something which is misunderstood.
Well, it is very much so, yeah. Certainly by politicians. The basic point of the matter is the sunk costs are sunk. There's nothing we can do about them. They have no impact on our future decisions other than embarrassment. In fact, the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2017 to a professor who has studied the sunk cost fallacy and written books on it. A businessman looks at the forward decisions that he can affect, not the historic decisions he can't. In our analysis, we only dealt with the $10 billion for the going ahead costs. And we ignored the $6 billion that have been already committed. And Premier Horgan, unfortunately, made a second error, and one he has not explained, which is, at the moment, he's borrowed $6 billion, mainly with 30-year bonds. And those $6 billion have an extensive amount of interest that they'll be paid over the next 30 years by taxpayers and ratepayers. But for some reason, he maintains that if he cancels the project, he's going to recover the money from ratepayers in 10 years, effectively forcing ratepayers to loan the province the full $6 billion for the intervening 20 years. 10 years they pay for it, but he will not be forced to pay off the bonds for an additional 20 years. That's an inexplicable decision, and certainly is inconsistent with the accounting standards in place across North America and used by virtually every utility in Canada and the United States.
That's very interesting. So almost basically a false statement to continue to push the project forward based on an arbitrary reasoning that has no basis in reality.
Right. We've seen no justification for it at all. The right answer, according to the accounting standards that the Auditor General of British Columbia has encouraged the government to adopt time and time again, to take this question to an independent regulatory commission that's called the British Columbia Utilities Commission, and let them decide the appropriate period for recovery. Now, it turns out they actually did that to a degree. They didn't state that they had made a final decision, nor was it within their mandate in 2017. But when they actually chose a number to use for recovery of these sunk costs, they chose 30 years. And of course, there's some common sense to it. If you're borrowing the money for 30 years, then you would normally repay it over 30 years. And obviously, the draconian impact of the termination goes away if you recover the money over the appropriate time period.
Right. And I also read in I think it was one of the press articles, that the government of BC is planning to delay the payment of the project cost for a period of 75 years. You know, is that correct, number one? And number two, you know, if that is the case, the interest payable over that period of time is probably going to double versus what it would be if we began those payments, as you suggest, on a 30-year amortization.
Well, it goes without saying that that's an odd number to use. So in general, regulatory theory says that it should be addressed over the expected lifetime of the project. But what is the lifetime of a hydroelectric project? Generally, 50 years is an honest estimate. Why is that? Well, at 50 years, it's appropriate to replace the generating equipment of the project, not the dam itself, but the turbines and the generators that produce the electricity. We're in the midst of such replacement exercises all over Canada and the United States, simply because many of our dams are now 50 years old. So 75 years is a lengthy period, but it is actually a little worse than that. As you know, the U.S. luckily did not elect the weird guy with the orange hair. And he was desperate to maintain the U.S. coal industry. Rather bewilderingly, I don't think he'd ever been to a coal mine and realized what a hard job that is. So we are retiring the coal units across the U.S. at an astonishing rate. Now, we're not doing it because the coal units are too old, though many of them are pretty long in the tooth. We're doing it because the change in technology has made coal units economically irrelevant. So it costs more to operate a coal unit than to simply buy the similar electricity from renewables, and of course, much cleaner. So the gamble is, in 2025, we will have Site C, and they're arguing that it will be abused to 2100. Well, think back a little bit. That takes you, if you thought back to about the time when some of us were born, and 1950, and the technologies we were discussing at the time. Well, in 1950, we had some of the brand new, wonderful coal units we're now discussing. Those are all obsolete. We were building the first fission power plants, nuclear power plants. Those are being closed for the same economic reasons. Our parents were buying very nice vinyl records, and they're playing them on record players. The first computer, the UNIVAC, which used so much power that the lights would flicker in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia when it was turned on, had less processing power by a factor of thousands. than your cell phone.
Sure, sure.
And gambling that 2100 is going to be a great day for size C, that's a fairly doubtful issue. The 75 years might, in fact, still have the dam standing if, of course, the fact that it's being built on shale is not a, does not turn out to be a crisis. But the economics of the dam is doubtful today and will be, frankly, mysterious to our grandchildren in 2100.
Sure, and I guess that also, there's another mysterious line item, which would be maintenance in terms of servicing cracks or grouting or, you know, a potential lowering of capacity due to needing to lower the reservoir from what its intended levels are. There's a myriad of potentialities there.
Well, and we see those. It's not unusual for dams to require serious maintenance. And as you know, within the last decade, we lost a major dam in British Columbia. And that was an industrial mining dam, not a hydroelectric dam. But they do need to be repaired.
For sure, for sure. So given all this then, am I correct in my understanding that you know, the economic reality here is that BC Hydro will never earn a dime from this operation, and that the entirety of the construction and operating costs are going to be borne by BC taxpayers and ratepayers?
Absolutely. And moreover, though the neighboring states of Oregon and Washington will be the winners in this project if it goes ahead, because the power will be sold at a fraction of its cost, I doubt that anyone will ever send you a thanks. I know Governor Inslee, he's a fine governor, but I somehow doubt he will call Premier Horgan and say, you're about to make a very bad economic decision that will benefit my state. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, I'm going to guess the other part of this too is that there's going to have to, you know, between the massive debt of, you know, what looks like $16, $18, maybe even $20 billion, this is going to have an effect on electricity rates in BC over the next 25, 50, and even 100 years.
It will. And there's no question that we're going to see upward pressure from this, and also several other massive investments that have been delayed. Every bond rating agency, when they review British Columbia, notes that BC Hydro already has more than $5 billion of delayed charges. So the rates in British Columbia are low. That's an excellent thing. But in part, they're low because these major investments have really not been recognized into the rate making process.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, really, there's only downside here for this project. I mean, to, you know, as BC Hydro operates as a crown corporation, their mandate is to, you know, work for the people of BC, and really, this is nothing but detrimental to the ratepayers, taxpayers, and residents of British Columbia.
So the right answer is the following: when the project was at 48% of completion, we asked the BCUC to review it. They did, found that it was not needed and that it was not cost effective. Today, the project is only a third done. It's less done than it was in 2017. We need to go back to the BCUC and actually have an expert determination of this. They are the right people to review it. They are the right people to protect ratepayers. And so it's incumbent upon Premier Horgan to actually let the regulators do their job. And of course, we've seen no indication that that will occur, but that certainly is the step that needs to be taken.
Well, which could also be an elegant means for him to exit this project where, you know, he's not the one seen personally canceling the project for specific reasons. He can defer the cancellation to the BC EU, or sorry, BC UE, and allow them to make that decision, and then his government would act upon it.
Well, Someone who believes strongly in checks and balances, I think this is the right answer. Why is it that we have both economists and engineers in a well-functioning agency? Well, the engineers like to build things, and the economists like to make sure they don't build the wrong things.
Sure, sure.
You need to have both points of view represented. At the moment, the engineers have gotten out of control, and I have no doubt they're doing the best possible job they can. But they are doing the wrong job.
Yes.
And so, you know, for the $10 billion we're talking about, we could simply write a check to each one of the workers at Sightseeing, give him $1 million and tell him to spend the next few years in Tahiti. We would be happier. And we would actually preserve a beautiful and pristine part of British Columbia.
Yes, yes. And am I correct in my assumption that British Columbia doesn't even really need this power? And certainly if the LNG projects don't go ahead, or if they go to completion and there's no market for the product, there's no need for this power here in BC.
Well, that's correct. If you look at the resource plans all the way up and down the I-5 corridor, from San Diego to the far south, to Seattle to the north, every utility is forecasting dramatically lower growth in demand. Seattle, in fact, the nearest and closest city to Vancouver, is forecasting a declining amount of electricity. That's not because their economic growth has diminished. To the contrary, what it is that we are now getting more efficient faster than we're growing. And you can see that example simply by looking up at the ceiling in your home. That LED that you replaced in the ceiling fixture is producing electricity at one-tenth the cost. I'm sorry, producing light at one-tenth the amount of electricity. And worse than that, or better in your case, is it won't wear out for a decade. And that represents the advance of technology in the energy business. And that's true of your air conditioner and your heater and your computer and almost every other device. We've just gotten a lot better over the last decade. And so it's pretty doubtful that we're going to see a tremendous need. Now, the one exception to that is electrification of transport. Absolutely necessary and cost effective. My Tesla is a much cheaper car to run than any petroleum car. But that will increase the energy needs. But interestingly enough, it doesn't increase the capacity needs. As we fuel our electric vehicles at night, not during the day, when we have a high use for electricity. So those are much better served by wind than the site C. So the only area of electricity demand that's growing actually is not a very good choice for site C to serve.
That's interesting. And certainly in the Sun Belt states, or you know, even from mid Oregon southward, I would imagine that many people, if they're going to be running an EV, they'll probably look to have a solar array on their roof and be independent of the grid, which I think is an entirely sort of different paradigm, moving away from large distribution to more centralized or you know, individual grids.
And in fact, even living on the west side of Oregon, I've looked into it.
Sure.
On the edge of being cost effective. But Oregon and Washington, remember, are half desert.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, I'm in the northern extension of your Oregon and Washington State interior desert here. So I'm familiar with that geotype there.
So we have tremendous opportunities for renewables. You know, one of the amusing facets about this debate is that both the cabinet and BC Hydro know that renewables don't work north of the Canadian border. And I was visiting on this issue with one of our clients in British Columbia. And I said, you know, If my ancestors had pushed the border north another 100 miles, Vancouver would be served by wind because the wind would work north of the border. And he said, well, of course, if my ancestors pushed the border 100 miles south, Seattle's rates wouldn't be falling as they embrace solar and wind. So it's entirely a political decision where technology operates.
Certainly. Certainly. And I think one of the major complaints that many enlightened British Columbians would have about BC Hydro is even their name suggests that they're not interested in power generation by any other means other than pouring water over a dam. And so I think there's a need to break up that crown corporation, and perhaps BC Hydro maintains its stranglehold on dams, and we create a new renewables or solar or wind division, which then has a mandate to produce power from those sources versus circle the wagons of their own power generation method.
Well, again, BC Hydro is an engineering organization. They've hungered after this project for 40 years, and it is a form of myopia that we all have. And it is certainly true that decision making at BC Hydro needs to be broadened. I sort of like the name, by the way, but the fact is, they do need a full reboot.
Yes, yes. So in your lengthy experience, have you come across another mega project of this type, which has been cloaked in such secrecy and lack of transparency and oversight?
Well, certainly not for the last 18 months. Now, bear in mind, the culture of the two countries, though we are close cousins and share almost all of our values, is different. Americans distrust their government and demand a high level of transparency. Canadians are more trusting in their government and are not quite as critical. But for 18 months, we have stopped seeing even the most minimal reports out of CITESI, and that is worrisome. In the absence of transparency, the ability of people to make unbelievable mistakes is enormous. In fact, the last report we have from CITESI comes from 2019, mid-2019. Yeah. And that indicated that the advisory committees were questioning the geotechnical basis for the dam. And at that point, the curtain was rung down and we heard nothing more. And so that's a very inappropriate way to make a decision. It's pretty clear that British Columbia Hydro deserves to immediately publish the two or three quarterly reports that they owe the BCUC. And those need to be reviewed by experts to make sure that the new $16 billion estimate makes sense. It's not every day that you can get a $5 billion budget increase without really the least explanation of where it's coming from.
Yeah. That's maybe a Canadian type situation. I don't think you'd get away with that in the U.S. You'd have lawsuits flying all over the place.
And a U.S. governor is nowhere near the powers of a premier like Oregon. If the governor of Oregon announced a $5 billion change, that would immediately be checked in the legislature. But bear in mind, as I had this discussion years ago with my friends in Quebec, and I said, well, it's interesting, the two countries have such different values on the value of government. And my friend, Robert Monville, who's now a judge, said, well, of course, my ancestors thought the king was just fine. Your ancestors did not. Not surprising, sure. Different points of view, both valid, but in this case, we do need to know where the $5 billion is going.
Yes, yes. So, we've sort of brushed on some of these geological realities that have prompted BC Hydro forced BC Hydro to have a radical redesign of the dam. We went from a fairly conventional straight across the valley structure to a highly unusual L shape. That is unproven design. And it seems that a number of engineering firms have signed off, but not actually guaranteed that technology. You know, what are your thoughts here on this? And, you know, again, we're building a dam without any bedrock to anchor it into.
Well, bear in mind, number one, I have to tell you, my engineering degree doesn't exist. So, but you can get the opinion of someone who's been in the business for 40 years and has worked on these issues and similar issues across North America. Number one, the design of the dam, both the use of rolled cement as opposed to the traditional cement, the shape of the dam, and of course, the presence of shale underneath pose three interesting challenges. Now, all of them might be just fine. As I said, the use of the rolled cement in Eastern Oregon had some substantial leakage issues. We have a dam in the Rockies, which is a geologically active area. We also have the shale issue. Now, I think most people don't quite understand that the shale itself is compressible. And the reason why the advisory committee 18 months ago were so worried was because the dam was actually, the current construction was compressing the shale and creating changes in movement far below the surface level. And that's sort of what happens when you try to build something that doesn't have a firm base. Now, Chicago, Illinois, where I was born, is actually a swamp. And so all of those incredible skyscrapers in the city have piles that go all the way down immense areas so that the buildings are stable with the terrible weather Chicago experiences. And even with them, by the way, when you're at the top of one of those skyscrapers during a Chicago windstorm, you can feel the building flex back and forth. So that's the solution we've chosen for Site C. We're going to put a pile down through the flexible materials till we have enough stability to guarantee it. Not an unprecedented solution. I've been in buildings that don't fall over because of this. But those buildings were not built in a geologically active area like the Rockies. So we'll just have to see whether this is going to work or not. And I read the engineering studies across the world on these issues. And a number of them said that given this technology of cement, there is a risk of sliding or cracking. And so that's something we can only hope has been very carefully evaluated. But again, we haven't seen any of this. We have one very short report released by the government on these geotechnical issues that came out a couple of weeks ago. But that's fairly brief for a $16 billion project. I think it was 50 pages.
Certainly. And then, of course, we have the other compounding issue. Once that reservoir is actually flooded, that we will also have the loading of the water on that underlying structure, as well as the dam, and that could complicate matters further.
Well, the sheer weight of the water will compress the shale underneath. So this is a very different world than the one I grew up in. So when you take the beautiful drive up the Columbia River from Portland all the way up to Canada, what you're in the midst of is a channel cut through the rock by millions of years of the Columbia River. The walls of that channel are solid rock. So when Franklin Delano Roosevelt proposed to build these dams in the 30s, this was not nearly the engineering challenge that we're seeing in Site C. And of course, I find those dams to be quite beautiful in the sense that they are fit that process very well. They're not a glaring surprise. And of course, roll on Columbia and all the rest. But the reality is this was a simple engineering problem compared to Site C.
Yes, yes. And then of course, we also have, you know, you've mentioned we have a seismically active area, but we've also seen about 10,000 earthquakes associated with fracking operations between 2017 and 2018 alone. Those are the last numbers that I could find. And one of those earthquakes in 2019 registered 4.5 magnitude, which caused an evacuation of the project site. So, you know, we have another layer of complication on the construction methods and potential problems given not only the seismically active area, but also the fracking operations, which are taking place.
And we're going to see that tested fairly soon because obviously the reason for the river diversion was the completion of the temporary structures. So we are filling that up. It is now March and we'll have our spring freshet coming in fairly soon. You know, it's very possible that British Columbians will be apologizing to their neighboring provinces for quite a while. I hope that's not the case. But, you know, we do live in a seismically active area. Portland, yes. Oregon has a volcano in its backyard. And it's implausible for us to assume that they never react. If you remember 30 years ago, the one just north of town blew up. So yeah. These events that do occur.
Yes.
And do occur in our lifetime.
Yes. So who will be liable if there's a catastrophic failure at Site C?
Well, obviously we don't know who will pay, but we'll know the lawyers will profit. Well, a catastrophic failure would obviously lead us to a whole set of damages downstream. As an economist, I'm no expert on that. I would recommend not building your vacation home downstream Site C until quite a period has passed, so you can be certain that it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, the reality here is, as much as we have studied this, and the proponents say, well, we've studied again and again, we're learning new things faster than we're studying it. We know less today than we did when we started this project, whatever it was, 5 years ago. And this is a preposterous situation, and one that I would not be at all comfortable with if I was a decision maker. And so
you wouldn't want your name on that dam, in other words.
No, and I doubt they're going to ask me. Robert Bourassa, the brilliant economist that was premier of Quebec for many years, he in fact built that first major dam on the north, and he died before it was built. And as a practical joke, they've named it after him. But the question is whether even a simple to design project like that can be done without major problems is unusual. There were problems with that project. And this was nowhere near as complicated an engineering issue as Site C.
Yes.
Site C is basically a very, very, very complicated place to build a dam.
Yes. So I understand that you're working with Westmoberly First Nations. How are they doing with their legal challenges today? Where does that stand?
I believe that they're on hold waiting for the court to proceed. And yes, we've been one of their witnesses. And we have worked for a number of Aboriginal groups in British Columbia over the years. Last year, I was deposed by ExxonMobil. And one of the questions was, why do you work for Indians? Which I find very, very funny. But the fact of the matter is that this dam is being built on their traditional territory. And I find that a very suitable group of people to work for. Fact is, if someone proposed a similar dam in Albany, Oregon, the farmers would be out shooting rifles at the bureaucrats.
Well, you have that lovely Second Amendment that our forefathers forgot to put in, so we're a little defenseless against our governments up here.
Well, bottom line is, these are property rights that Canada has to address, and yes. Overlay is taking it to court, and I wish them the best. I think if you're great, 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 to the 10th power ancestors were camping by the Peace River. They have a very strong moral right to exercise their rights on that.
Yes. And of course, this project seems to fly in the face of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Excellent letter to the editor in the Montreal Gazette yesterday from... the Grand Council of Cree, who are also clients of ours. And
okay.
So the bottom line in all of this is, can you work with the people who have property rights where the dam is? And the answer is yes, you can. You just have to roll up your sleeves and do the right thing. And I, you know, fact of the matter is that it is surprising to folks in the U.S. to find that Aborigines in Canada have fewer rights than they do in the U.S. I mean, the first time I learned it, I couldn't believe it.
Interesting. And I would imagine that if this project was taking place in the United States, that there would be a number of legal challenges against this project. Would that be correct? There'd be some...
Right. Well, yeah. The whole basis of U.S. law is... to keep the government in check. The project would be subject to explicit regulatory review by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Every piece of paper would be public and would be reviewed. It would also be subject to the full regulatory review of the state. All of the information would be subject to the National Freedom of Information Act and the comparable state rules. So we wouldn't be guessing what the $5 billion were in the states, which is, I think, a very strong issue. Let's be very blunt. Things that are done in the dark don't often turn out very well.
Yes.
So we certainly need to get that data out in front of everyone so we can evaluate it. And as I noted, this interest rate hedging, as far as I can see, British Columbia Hydro hasn't even turned in the mandated reports on that to the Regulatory Commission. It's only $1 billion, but some of us would like to know what the status of it is.
For sure. So in your opinion then, you know, why is the BC government continue to blindly forge ahead with this project? Is it, you know, loss of face and maintaining those jobs? I mean, that's kind of just where we're at, or what do you think there?
Well, I often say there are mistakes so evocative we make them again and again. We've invaded Iraq 5 times in the last century or so, never enjoyed it much. In this case, clearly this is a job creation exercise. And it's understandable that government should view that as one of their missions. Fine. But as been noted before, you can build an awful lot of hospitals and electrify an awful lot of transportation and schools and universities with $6 billion. So as job creation, this is apparently not creating a lot of jobs, and it's pretty damn expensive to boot.
Yes.
Clearly, if we want to have job creation, we're better off spending money on a first-rate university than a dam that is economically obsolete on its first day.
Yes, well said. So if you had an opportunity to address the government of BC in regards to this Site C project, and they were actually gonna listen, what would you have to say to them?
Well, the same thing I did say to them. Now, compliment to Premier Horgan, I was invited to attend a cabinet meeting and make my presentation directly to the cabinet in 2017. I'm told that's the first time that outside experts were ever invited to a cabinet meeting, which is pretty interesting. And obviously, I did not win that debate. That's fine. I've lost debates before. But I would certainly counsel them that sunk costs are, in fact, sunk. And it is ridiculous to worry about looking bad in front of Moody's bond raters, because Moody's bond raters know that the existing $6 billion is sunk. I'm still certain that the cabinet does not understand the transformation in energy technology we've seen in the last decade. You know, a decade ago, the U.S. was not the largest single oil producer in the world. Think of that transformation. And so BC Hydro is continuing to keep its head in the sand is not admitting that the whole economics of energy has been transformed over the last decade. And finally, of course, I would exhort them to open the books. It is clear from the reports we've read that the government did not get a clear statement of where things stood. That's very clear from the report we did publish. The checks and balances were not in place. And quite frankly, I suspect Premier Horgan was as surprised as we were when he finally got the bill. And now that's done. But what about next year? And that's a serious concern we have to be raised. It's got to be transparent.
Yes, yes. So, Mr. McCullough, if you could go back in time and speak with yourself as a young 18 or 20-year-old young fellow, knowing what you know now, what information, what would you share with that young person?
Well, number one, I would choose the same woman.
Okay. is she listening?
Luckily, after 2 years with her, I made a good choice at that
point. Well, congratulations.
Important, considering that we've all been stuck at home for a year. It's nice to still like your wife. But on a more serious note, what I've learned about economics is pretty straightforward. You need to have an open dialogue on each of these steps. We've made terrible errors over my lifetime in energy policy. And most of it is simply because we did not actually do our homework. And so the last round of hydroelectric development in Canada is on sites that were less attractive and probably should not have been built on. And there were alternatives. But it's not as if Canada was alone in that mistake. We still have nuclear plants under construction in the United States who are equally economically preposterous. And so it does require an open debate to actually make sure things are on the right track. And just so that our Canadian listeners don't think that I'm being unduly hard on Canada, you did not spend the last 4 years with the worst president in U.S. history who wanted to resurrect the coal industry in the United States in spite of the obvious environmental concerns and the fact that it couldn't pay for itself. So this is a common problem in a democracy, and we just simply have to bear down and face up to it. And so British Columbia needs a lot more information on this dam, and an expert decision by its regulatory commission to decide whether it's worthwhile going forward.
Yeah, well said, well said. Well, sir, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a very illuminating conversation. It's always a pleasure to speak with a gentleman with such great knowledge on a subject. And I hope that the listeners gain some information here and maybe make some phone calls or write some emails to their elected representatives and share some of the points that have been brought up here and, you know, push towards calling an end to this crazy escapade.
Well, I hope they do. And it is If anyone wants more information, our website is available. And quite often after these, I'll get an email or a phone call from your listeners, and that's fine as well.
Okay, and that's mresearch.com?
Right. And bottom line is, it's time to have another visit at the BCUC to figure out where this is going.
Yeah.
In public.
Yeah, very good. Well, and hopefully you get another opportunity to sit in front of cabinet and educate them as to why they're making some poor choices and perhaps lead them towards a more appropriate path of action.
Indeed. And I enjoyed that invitation a great deal. And as I said, I find Premier Horgan a very impressive individual. But I think in this case, he may be on the wrong path.
Yes, yes. Well, that's very diplomatically said, my friend.
Thank you for the invitation, and I'll look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Okay, thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.